The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're off and running on yet another week of broadcasting here at KPCG and KPCG.fm. Lots to get to on today's program. We've got another update on Brexit. Should be a big week in the UK. And with that in mind, we have Richard Palmer subbing in on tomorrow's program. So he's back from his vacation. He's handed me a stack of news this morning, and then we'll take to the mic tomorrow to give you what really you don't hear anywhere else, certainly not here in the United States. We're so preoccupied with all things politics, and so Richard will fill in tomorrow and give us the latest, the very latest on Brexit. Well, we've got a fair bit to summarize even here today. Today's the day that the so-called surrender bill is due to be signed into law by the Queen, and then the Commons is going to be holding another vote on the election. And you know some of the details from last week, how that we said the Labour said no election, no snap election until the surrender bill is passed. And so once it's passed, presumably sometime later today, then they really are exposed, the Labour Party. They're exposed for they're backing themselves into a corner because now that it's passed, then why shouldn't we have the snap elections? That's what they're saying on the Conservative side. So we're looking like there's not going to be an election before the October 31st deadline. And yet, that said, just judging by some of the polls over the weekend, it's looking pretty good for Boris Johnson and the Conservatives. The latest poll results from Saturday night put the Conservatives up three points from where they were previously, 35%, which is ahead of Labour's 25%. And this says here 37% said they approved of Boris Johnson's Brexit strategy, with only 17% backing Jeremy Corbyn's. 37% to 17%. The Telegraph said this: the findings appear to fly in the face of events in Parliament last week when Mr. Johnson failed to stop Remainer MPs from legislating to delay Brexit or secure the election he believes is required to break the deadlock. And so here again, you'll get some of the liberal reporting and assume that everything is going bad for Johnson and the Conservatives. But that's not necessarily the case. And the public sentiment is in favor of a no-deal Brexit. They've voted 3 years on now. And many in Britain are saying, why is it taking so long? Why is this not going through? Listen to what, this is the Beatles. I think Ringo Starr was the drummer, right? He's the drummer of the Beatles. And this is what he said on BBC Newsnight, I believe last evening, clip four.
The people voted and, you know, they have to get on with it. Not, suddenly it's like, oh, well, we don't like that vote. And what do you mean you don't like that vote? You had the vote. This is what won. Let's get on with it.
Would you have voted that way?
Have voted for Brexit, yes. I would have voted to get out. But don't tell Bob Geldof.
Why did you vote that way, Ringo?
Well, because I think it's a great move. I think, you know, to be in control of your own country is a good move.
That's Ringo Starr of the Beatles. Basically summarizing the popular sentiment in Britain today. I gave you some stats there from the poll from over the weekend. And Richard has said, just with the few people he's talked to, obviously this is just anecdotal, but with the few people that he's talked to in God's church that have mingled with others in the nation of Britain, they're coming. Of course, there's a lot of Remainers who are still out there. They're in the Labour Party, for that matter. And they obviously have the media on their side. But there are a lot of people in Britain who are absolutely disgusted by what has happened, by what hasn't happened in these past 3 years. A lot of people who are upset by what's going on. Even within the Labour Party, Richard was pointing out this morning how that they've had a strong anti-EU minority. You don't hear much about them. The minority in the Labour Party that actually want to get out of the EU. And you talk about people who are disgusted. Here they are in the Labour Party. They're supporting Jeremy Corbyn. And yet they're watching what's happening. And they can't believe it. You think they're going to vote Labour? You think they're going to be eager? All that you'll see, typically, is the divisions. Even yesterday, you saw a lot of the headlines at Drudge trying to draw attention to the divisions in the Republican Party, as if some of these Republican candidates who are going to try to challenge Donald Trump have any chance whatsoever. And yet the media, they'll give them voice. They were on the Sunday shows yesterday. Yes, I'm going to try to primary Donald Trump because we've got to bring sanity to the Republican Party. Well, there's a large majority of Republicans who support President Trump. And we're not here, of course, as God's church or work taking sides with any of these parties. We're just pointing out the approach that the media that they're going to take over and over again. We heard about the division in Boris Johnson's own family last week. Well, Jeremy Corbyn's brother, Pierce, he's split with his brother. In fact, he's attacking his brother's position. He tweeted out that 5 million leavers voted Labour at the last election. I don't think they'll vote Labour next time. So much for Labour respecting the result of the 2016 referendum. He's talking about members of the Labour Party who want to leave. It's like Ringo Starr. Who would have thought we'd have to go to Ringo Starr for sanity in this Brexit mess? What a messy divorce. The people have voted, so let's get on with it. Let's get on with it. And we'll play a clip later from the Irish Premier, just to give you, you know, we've talked a lot this past week about what is happening in Britain and what Britain thinks. Well, what about the European nations, the members of the European Union? We'll come to that in just a bit. But speaking of the divisions, they're there on both sides. But with respect to conservatives, Nigel Farage, he wrote a column at the Telegraph. And it was pretty complimentary of Boris Johnson. So when you have these two coming together, you've got a strong majority in Britain. There's no way around it. This is from Farage's article at the Telegraph. He said Boris Johnson is to be congratulated for sacking the 21 Tory MPs who voted to block a no-deal Brexit last week. He said it was a radical move on his part. But contrary to what the moaners and whiners have been bleating about, it was not without precedent in parliamentary history. It says, furthermore, the rebels knew exactly what they were doing. And like we noted last week, if there's one thing that this action from Boris Johnson has done, it's exposed the people in his own party who aren't on board with Brexit. It's exposed the swamp, so to speak. Farage says here, these self-serving men and women, many of them not proper conservatives anyway, all received fair warning that their arrogance and disloyalty would have consequences. It says, when you commit an act of political sabotage, you earn your punishment. So that's Nigel Farage. He's heading up the Brexit party. And then you have Boris Johnson over the Conservative Party. And there's Farage saying Johnson did the right thing. They got what they deserved, those MPs that got booted out. Farage writes, Johnson's decisiveness proves something much more significant than just his ability to bring his party to heel, however, for the events of this summer confirm that the center of gravity in British politics is shifting inexorably in favor of Brexit. It says a much-needed realignment is taking place. I've been arguing for this for years, and I'm only too delighted that the swamp is being drained at last. That's Nigel Farage saying that the swamp has been drained at last. He's out there offering Boris Johnson a non-aggression pact where these two parties can now work together to follow through on the will of the people. And then when you listen to the other side, this next clip we have, it's from Question Time. That's the Thursday night program on BBC, I think it is. But this is a panel of people or a panel of commentators and or politicians who are in front of a British audience, and they move around the country from place to place. But it's a good program. It's one that Melanie Phillips often goes on. And again, usually, the views of the public, the views of the people are pretty left-wing. They're right on board with BBC and all them. But with respect to Brexit, here's the moderator trying to pin down the representative for the Labour Party. I forget her name, Thornberry maybe. But she's a Labour MP, and she's trying to explain her position. Just listen to this. This is clip one.
If you were to win a general election, which I think is the point you're getting to, you would go back to Europe, try and get a better deal, have a referendum where Remain is an option. Would you then be campaigning against your own deal to Remain? Against your own deal that you probably would have negotiated? Or would you be actually saying, no, support our deal? I mean, if I'm confused, I don't know. Which is it? Briefly. Briefly. Are you going to campaign for your deal? Assuming you get one, assuming you get into power.
I think we've had our answer.
Or will you campaign for Remain? Against your own deal?
Personally, I will campaign to Remain.
Even if you've negotiated the deal?
I will negotiate the best of my ability a deal that will look after jobs and the economy. But the best way of looking after jobs and the economy is for us to Remain.
Do you have any idea how ridiculous that sounds to everybody watching this program? To vote for you on that basis. Have you no shame?
Have you any idea how the European Union are going to treat us if we negotiate in that way? Can you give us a nice deal, please? And then I'm going to vote not to have it in the first place. Utterly, utterly ridiculous.
And there they are on the panel, ganging up on the Labour MP, something you don't see that often. But here they want power. They want the power to go and negotiate on their terms, of course. They don't want snap elections in mid-October because they know they'll lose. But they're out there saying, look, we should be in charge. We should be negotiating. We're the ones that would get the best deal. Well, but you don't want a deal, do you? You just want to stay in the EU. Well, yeah, actually, we do. That's what they're saying. And they're out there having to try to explain this. Do you realize how ridiculous that sounds? We've had the vote. We've had the referendum. So let's get on with it, says the Beatles drummer. Listen to this commentator on Sky News. He's trying to summarize the constantly evolving position of the Labour Party. Clip two.
I restrain my remarks merely to noting the Labour position as it's evolved, which was respect the result of the referendum, and to do anything otherwise would be wrong, to we should have a general election, to if we can't have a general election, we should have a referendum, to we should have a referendum and Remain should be on the ballot, to we should have a referendum, Remain should be on the ballot and we'll campaign for that, to sod that idea of an election before. Actually, your offer of an election is a dictatorial coup. Two, we should be the government, we should do the renegotiation, and we'll get a better deal, and then we'll campaign against it. The modern Labour Party.
That's the modern Labour Party. We should be in charge. We'll get a better deal. And then we'll try to campaign against the deal because actually we want to remain. That's Labour today. They're backing themselves into a corner. Now, we'll look at what God has to say about this. That's all that matters. And we've said before and over and again, although we haven't maybe gone through some of these quotes in a few months, what Mr. Armstrong was saying in 1956 and even in Mystery of the Ages, the last year of his life, about Britain not being a part of the now forming Union of Nations in Europe, the seventh and final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. Here's Fraser Nelson from The Telegraph. This is from Friday. He said, a great many people see in all of this a leader finally determined to act and break free of Parliament's traps. The House of Commons may be revered by its members, but not by the public. It says a recent European poll shows just one in five Brits saying they tend to trust Parliament. So it's very similar to the way it is here in the United States with Congress. He writes, only the Bulgarians and the Croats have less faith in their legislature. Fraser points to opinion polls that show a surge in support for the Tories since the Boris era began, from about 25% to 20% to 35%. It says add to that 12% support for the Brexit Party, and you have almost half the country backing either Nigel Farage or Boris Johnson. You think about this, and again, the parallels, the resurgence, what we have on the latest cover of the Trumpet magazine. Fraser Nelson says, if these polls were to be tomorrow's election results, you'd end up with a 50-strong majority for the Conservatives. It would be the party's best in three decades. We're talking about quite a resurgence here. And it's just like what we're seeing in the United States. Bear in mind, it's temporary. We know this. James Dellingpole, he's a conservative author, writing in the UK, but he also contributes, I think, to Breitbart. But he sums it up this way, saying it really does feel as though after three lost decades, we genuine conservatives have finally got our party back again. So the conservatives, they're not necessarily cowering in fear. Many of them are saying it's about time. It's about time. Even here in the U.S., you see, and it happened the last election cycle as well, with some prominent voices even resigning, Republicans saying, well, it's time for us to move on. And then there was a headline the other day about, I think, 11 or 12 more congressmen that are stepping aside that want to get out. And who knows why? They have, I'm sure they all have different reasons. But there are some Republicans who just cannot get on board with the current administration. And so they're leaving the scene, or in some cases, they're being forced out. In the case of the UK, they were booted out. And then others saying it's about time that we've drained the swamp. Here's what Dellingpole said in his Breitbart piece. Until Boris and the ruthless axeman, Dominic Cummings, until they took over, the Conservative Party was dying and thoroughly deserving of death in its desperation to appeal to centrists with no real sympathy for conservative values. It ditched most of its principles and showed nothing but contempt for its base. Here again, the same story in the U.S. The Republican Party was dying as it was trying to reach out to the so-called moderates, abandoning conservative positions. And who would have thought it would take someone like Donald Trump, of all people? He comes along and he sounds more conservative than some of these establishment Republicans ever did. It's quite a story. Who would have predicted this? This Dellingpole piece says David Cameron made this contempt quite explicit when he described himself as the heir to Blair. I'm the heir to Blair, said Cameron. Cameron here was doing something similar to what his even more useless successor, Theresa May, did when she described the Conservatives as the nasty party, effectively conceding to the left that there is something shaming about conservative values and that the only way to rescue the tarnished brand would be to focus on social issues like gay marriage and bang the drum for our creaking socialistic NHS and ruthlessly weed out any potential conservative candidates who sounded or looked like actual conservatives. This is James Dellingpole at Breitbart. Listen to this conclusion. It says, but these are just details. What matters far more is the bigger picture. For the first time since the 1980s, Britain finally has a government which is recognizably conservative and is acting in accordance with the values of an essentially conservative country. Well, we'd have something to say about whether or not it's truly conservative with respect to morals. It certainly isn't. And that's the same story here in the U.S. But politically, this is significant. 30 years. Dellingpole says, I believe, though, that Britain is on the verge of entering another golden age and that Boris Johnson is set to join Winston Churchill and Margaret Thatcher as one of three great conservative prime ministers in the last 100 years. How about that? A temporary resurgence. You can't obviously put him up there with Churchill. But these are some excited conservatives. They like what's going on. They like the fact that the swamp is being drained. And they are having some success. The conservative wing in the UK, here in the US. As far as Johnson's options going forward, there's a report in the Telegraph about his administration working on plans to, quote, sabotage, unquote, the Brexit extension. You can be sure they're working behind closed doors to try to carry out the will of the people. The referendum happened 3 years ago. Let's get on with it. That's the approach they're taking, and they're getting a lot of support from the public. The Telegraph says Boris Johnson has drawn up plans to sabotage any Brexit extension without breaking the law, the Telegraph has learned. It means Monday's vote on a general election is the last chance for MPs to block a no-deal Brexit, the government believes. It says one plan under serious consideration would see the Prime Minister send an accompanying letter alongside the request to extend Article 50, setting out that the government does not want any delay after October 31st. So Parliament may say, we've got to be able to delay it. But in the negotiations, in the dealing, there may be an accompanying letter coming from Boris Johnson telling the EU, we don't want an extension. We don't want for you to grant us an extension. It says on Sunday night, this is from last night then, a cabinet source told the Telegraph, there is a prescribed letter that has to be sent. Does that stop the Prime Minister sending other documents to the EU? I don't think so. I don't think it does. Okay, so if we have to do this, we'll go ahead and do it. But we're going to send some other things too, just so that you know. It says a political explainer, perhaps, as to where the government's policy is. It has to make clear that the government is asking for an extension, but let's not forget what the next step is. And then it says here later, there is a clear path now, the Telegraph writes. The Europeans need to refuse an extension. And so that then brings us to the European states, the members of the European Union, that have been here watching this messy divorce, the messy divorce proceedings, as they've gone on now for over 3 years. And some in Europe are beginning to say what Ringo Starr said. You guys voted on it. Okay, let's get on with it. Boris Johnson yesterday was in Dublin with the Irish Prime Minister, Leo Varadkar. And listen to the Irish Premier, what he had to say. He has while he's saying this, he has Boris Johnson right next to him. And here's what he had to say about Brexit, clip three.
If it comes to a request for an extension, I think the vast majority of countries around the table would prefer that there not be an extension. We would like to see this dealt with. If the UK is leaving, it should leave on the 31st of October. But as the President of the Commission, incoming President of the Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, has said, if there is a good reason to have an extension, then we would consider it. But I think we would all prefer to have this resolved in October so that the UK can leave the European Union, begin its new journey in the world. We can continue with our domestic priorities here, and the European Union can focus on all the other issues that we want to deal with. But because of Brexit, time to deal with those has been lost.
Because of Brexit, all the other issues that they want to deal with, time has been lost. He said, I think we all prefer that this would be finalized by October 31st. Ross Clark at The Spectator. This is from a couple days ago. He says, but is delaying an election really in the interests of Remain? The trouble is that while Hillary Benn's bill, which will become law on Monday, would oblige the prime minister, be it Boris or anyone else, to request an extension to Article 50 if no deal can be reached by 19 October, it doesn't and couldn't possibly oblige the EU to accept such a request. Given that such an extension would have to be ratified by all EU members, there are some doubts as to whether the EU would approve an extension. Emmanuel Macron, for one, is believed to be lukewarm to the idea. And then it says this, there's another EU leader who is known to be not so keen on the idea of an extension either. That would be Boris Johnson. It says, ultimately, the Prime Minister has it in his power to make sure that the UK does not get an extension, even while fulfilling his legal duty to request one, by making certain demands that the EU is bound to refuse. So it does seem like there are still a few aces up the sleeve of Johnson's administration. Stepping back, of course, we know where this is leading ultimately. In 1956, that was when Britain joined the EU. Think of it, it's 60 years on from that, almost 70, I guess. 65 years, Mr. Armstrong wrote, Germany is the economic and military heart of Europe. Probably Germany will lead and dominate the coming United States of Europe, but Britain will be no part of it. Britain's not going to be part of it, he said back in 1956. Britain was part of it for, what, 60, 65 years? And now they're on the way out. Mr. Armstrong reiterated this in Mystery of the Ages, his 1985 book. He said, the soon-coming resurrected Holy Roman Empire, a sort of soon-coming United States of Europe, a union of 10 nations, will rise up out of or following the common market of today. Britain will not be in that empire soon to come. Britain's not going to be in it. And so that's our predecessor, The Plain Truth, Mr. Armstrong's World Tomorrow program. And that's why the trumpet, beginning in the 1990s, that's why we've consistently proclaimed this same message. Germany's to be the leader of a united Europe. Britain's not going to be a part of it. And so on. You can see there on the YouTube stream the magazine cover from 2016. And the quote from Mr. Armstrong, the 1956 quote, Britain's not going to be a part of it. We had that in the trumpet soon after the Brexit referendum. You think about these keynote prophecies from Herbert Armstrong, Germany as the leader of Europe, for example. I just mentioned that. And then he talked about the woman straddling the beast, the involvement of the Great False Church, and so on. And then the confidence-inspiring leader, the Daniel 8 man, And then in the mix of all these prophecies, there was Herbert Armstrong saying that Britain would not be part of it. If you want to study this more, or at least these major prophecies that are being fulfilled, make sure that you immerse yourself into the content in the United States and Britain in prophecy. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Is prophecy real? Is it anything more than a collection of imaginations, vagaries, and wishful thinking? The answer is no. Human beings have never dreamed up an authentic prediction of the future. The human mind simply isn't capable of it. Such a feat would require godlike power. What about Bible prophecy? Is Bible prophecy real? Is it different than the litany of other failed prophecies that have been discarded throughout human history? Unlike other books, particularly those books that claim to predict the future, the Bible has endured for thousands of years. Something about this book has transcended thousands of generations of human history. And this book, the Holy Bible, claims to predict the future. It claims its prophecies come not from the minds of human beings, but from the mind of their Creator, from the mind of God. Prove the Bible's prophecies for yourself. If you cannot honestly prove them to be true, discard the Bible and move on with your life. But if you can, what a spectacular book the Bible becomes. Request Herbert W. Armstrong's free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. This book will examine the core Bible prophecies and compare them to history and current events. More than 6 million people have requested this amazing and easy-to-read book. Order The United States and Britain in Prophecy by Herbert W. Armstrong and prove Bible prophecy for yourself. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily.
In a message that my father gave over the weekend, he referred to this famous passage from Julius Caesar, Shakespeare's play. And this is a passage he's actually referred to in two or three meetings recently as well. So it's definitely been impressed upon his mind, the significance of it. But the passage reads, "There's a tide in the affairs of men, which, taken at the flood, leads on to fortune. Omitted, all the voyage of their life is bound in shallows and in miseries. On such a full sea are we now afloat, and we must take the current when it serves or lose our ventures." We must take the current. We've got to take advantage of the opportunities that are there in front of us. I recently encouraged the students here at Armstrong College to take advantage of the opportunities that are there in front of them. Young people, generally speaking, they've just got a longer life ahead of them, a longer physical life, and so there are more opportunities available to them if they are observant to them and if they will take advantage of them. But it's also easy to just kind of sit back, to not step forward, as Hebrews 10 brings out, to not have a step forward attitude, but to just drift back into the background and to miss those opportunities or to watch them go by. At the AC orientation a few weeks back, my father talked about his experiences at Ambassador College in the 1960s. And how that he went there as an older married student, but he said that he witnessed quite a few young people who were there, 18, 19, 20 years of age. They were there at AC, and they were just basically there to have fun. They were there to goof off, even. and they weren't really hungering and thirsting for God's truth. We have a new booklet coming out, the Book of Hebrews. I don't know if that's posted at the website yet. I don't think it is. But in any event, my father says on page 24 of that booklet, we must not let this slip away, as most of God's people have. God will not allow anyone to drift into this wonderful future, this wonderful calling that we have. We can't drift into it. If you look at that word drift in Webster's, it means to be carried slowly by a current of air or water. Carried slowly, like in a stagnant pond. Quite unlike what Shakespeare was describing in Julius Caesar, getting up on that tide, getting into that current when it serves, so that we can go along with the momentum and really move forward with God. Over the weekend, I was looking at some of the lessons from Winston Churchill's early life. I've got the lecture today in the Churchill class. But what an inspiring, there's so many examples there when he's in his late teens, early 20s, that we can just put right in front of our young people here at the college and say, look at this man. This was a man that didn't even have his mind open to God's truth. But at the same time, Churchill, nobody would ever accuse Winston Churchill of drifting. He did not drift through life. He was constantly on the lookout for the moving tide and current so that he could get on board with it. Spiritually, that's the way we want to be. We can't take this for granted, this opportunity that's there in front of us. We want to go after opportunities. And Churchill certainly did that. He went after it. He asked his mother, he asked his any contacts that he made, if he could get an opportunity, and it wasn't just for self-serving luxuries. I guess some would have accused him of having self-serving motives, because he did. He was a seeker of fame and action and stardom, but it was all in service to the empire, and he was risking his life. And with respect to the requests he made to go out onto the frontier in India to fight for the empire, or down in the Sudan, the Battle of Omdurman, Churchill wrote in his autobiography about some of these requests. There were some people that didn't want him to join their forces because, well, he was also a roving reporter. And they didn't like the fact that he was an officer on the front lines, and then he would send his dispatches back to the Telegraph and get paid for that. And, you know, people would kind of see the war through Churchill's eyes rather than the general's. But Churchill's point in the autobiography was that, look, if we're volunteering to go out on the front lines, we're basically volunteering to go out and stop a bullet. So if that's the motivation, then we ought to be able to do that. We're offering our services. We're putting our life on the line. That's someone who wasn't drifting by any means. Here at God's College, as I told the students last week, you can't drift through this program. You have to take God's tide at the flood. You have to take it at the flood. You have to take the current when it serves, or else you'll lose your ventures. So much comes down to the decisions that we make day in and day out. There's that quote in the Jude booklet about it being the worst time ever, and yet it's the best time ever for opportunities. So many opportunities. In Jude 1, it says, Jude, the servant of Jesus Christ, the brother of James, to them that are sanctified by God the Father and preserved in Jesus Christ, and called, sanctified, preserved, and called. In the booklet, my father says that this is talking about God's careful selection process. God puts a lot of time and preparation into bringing all of us into his family. My father wrote, so before God invited you, you had a history with God. We've all had some kind of history. And my father, he mentions in this New Hebrews booklet, the example's also there in the Jude booklet, but this experience he had as a young man in his early 20s, living with five other guys in an apartment. And one of the guys he was living with, this was when my father's life was, it really was just kind of drifting, but he met up with this roommate who was a deep thinker, and he read and studied challenging materials. And his example challenged my father to dig, to study, to read things that he wouldn't have read otherwise. In the Jude booklet, my father says, I don't believe God could have ever worked with me, with my ignorance and temperament, before I got to know this young man. That experience conditioned my mind in some ways to receive God's truth. So before he was invited into the church, God had to condition his mind. God had to prepare his mind to receive the truth. And you put that together, that example, together with other things he's written, like in that prophet where he talked about how his life just really bottomed out by the time he was 25 years of age. And he just felt like his life was empty. He didn't have any hope. He didn't have the best upbringing. His father was an alcoholic, and his life was a mess once he got out on his own. He wanted to get out on his own because his father was so hard on him. And then he got out into the world and saw that, well, it's not all that it's cracked up to be. And then his mother, my grandmother, she was listening to Herbert Armstrong and became a member of God's church and tried to encourage my father to listen to Mr. Armstrong. And at first, of course, he hated that. He hated having his arm twisted, but his life kept, it bottomed out eventually to where finally he had nothing else to turn to. He said in that prophet, I eventually came into the church and began to think of Mr. Armstrong as a father. My own father was lacking in many ways. He didn't know how to teach me. No one had taught him. But I saw that Mr. Armstrong was very stable. Following him helped me stabilize my life and become stronger. So he came into God's family, he came into the church, and his life stabilized. He saw that in Mr. Armstrong there was stability. And so step by step, God had prepared him for that invitation. In the Jude booklet, it says, you don't just stumble into God's church. We are invited by God. He said, there are no accidental sons in God's family, like an accidental pregnancy. God calculates it to the most minute detail. Sometimes that goes back decades, the sanctification, the preservation, and then finally, the invitation. I've been focusing on this some at the PAX that we've been sponsoring this summer. These events all over North America, preaching God's truth to trumpet readers, and emphasizing even to them that God is working in their lives. They've been exposed to the truth after all. Now, it may be early on in the process of the sanctification, the preservation, and then the invitation. But still, there's a lot of trumpet readers that while they're not members in God's church, they can certainly see what's happening in the UK and around the world and have some special insights into where all of this is headed. Well, for those of us here, those of us in the work, those of us in the church, what an opportunity this represents. Hebrews 2 and verse 1, it says, "Therefore we ought to give the more earnest heed to the things which we have heard, lest at any time we should let them slip." Give the more earnest heed to those things we've heard before, because we don't want them to slip away. Paul is emphasizing just how easy it is to drift, even to drift away from God's church, to wander away from God's commandments. It says in Psalm 119 and verse 10, "Let me not wander from your commandments." Don't let me slip. Don't let me drift. He goes on to say here in Hebrews, verse 3, "How shall we escape? How shall we escape if we neglect so great salvation, which at the first began to be spoken by the Eternal and was confirmed unto us by them that heard him?" How are we going to escape if we neglect so great salvation, if we neglect this truth, the truth of God? It says in verse 10, "For it became him," this is speaking of Christ, "for it became him for whom are all things and by whom are all things, in bringing many sons unto glory, to make the captain of their salvation perfect through sufferings." We have a captain, and he's leading many sons. It's not just about one father-son team, and that's it. Or it's certainly not a closed-off trinity. It says, bringing many sons to glory, and the captain's leading the way. Christ is the captain. He's leading us. My father says in the Hebrews booklet that if it's a general presiding over the army, and in a sense, I guess Christ fulfills that responsibility too. But if it's a general, he's more in the background surveying the scene, but that a captain is out front. That's what Winston Churchill was. He was a man of action. He was leading from the front. He was leading the charge at Omdurman. That was a man of courage. He didn't drift. He didn't drift into those positions. He almost, in the case of Sudan, he almost pushed his way in. Because Herbert Kitchener, he didn't want him there. Even when the prime minister requested, the prime minister had read a book by Churchill. This is a young man in his 20s. And he's given audience with the prime minister. And the prime minister himself contacted Kitchener, or at least the prime minister's office, and said, "Hey, I think you ought to let Churchill join your troops." And even then, Kitchener said no. And it was finally another contact that Churchill had that opened the way for him to join the cavalry, the 21st Lancers, the last great cavalry charge in British history. 1898, I think it was. The captain. Our captain is Jesus Christ. He's leading the charge. And if we follow him, we are certain to finish the race. If we just keep moving forward, if we just keep following Jesus Christ, we will finish. We'll finish out in front. That's Hebrews chapter 2. Let me just look at chapter 12 here briefly. Chapter 2 talks about not neglecting this great salvation. And then if you look at chapter 12, where it talks about that pioneer or that captain, as I say, I'm having to turn over to it. It's not in my notes here, but chapter 12 and verse 1, it says, "Wherefore, seeing we are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us." and let us run with patience the race that is set before us. Lay aside those sinful weights and really run after our captain. Follow our captain. Verse 2, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. See, he's the author. He's the beginner. He's the captain. He's the one who started it. But he also finishes, which is why we follow the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. There's our captain whom we follow, and he leads us right into God's family. Well, I'll leave it just a little bit short today as I finish off with my preparation for the Churchill class. Don't forget that tomorrow on the program, you've got Richard Palmer reporting from live from our Edstone campus, giving you the very latest on all that's happening in British politics. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.